thank you all for coming out. I gave a talk, I think, about a year and a half ago in this series, and the questions were so so stinging, so learned, so persistent, that I was curled up in the fetal position for several weeks until I recovered, and then Sean and Kyla invited me to come back to be punished again and talk about do we really care about climate change. So I'll try and do that. Sean quoted Freud, and Freud opens my talk here. In The Future of an Illusion, Freud comments, "Untold numbers of civilized human beings who would recoil from murder or incest do not deny themselves satisfaction of their greed, aggression, or sexual desires, and will not hesitate to harm others through lying, cheating, and calumny if they can get away with it." So in junior high, I did a report on the Ford Pinto scandal. I had to look up the numbers to refresh my memory a little bit. But Ford knew as they were producing the Pinto, because of crash testing they did, that if it was rear-ended, it had this tendency to burst into flames. They made a decision, we learned later after the lawsuits, to not install an $11 piece, which was about 0.5% of the retail cost of the vehicle, that would have prevented, they estimated, about 180 burn deaths, 180 burn victims, and about $2,000 burned Ford Pintos. So they made this calculation. Would have cost $137 million to install the piece. Based on these unit cost calculations, it would cost $43 million to just pay out-of-court settlements. So they decided just to not fix the car. And in 1970, the unit cost of a dead body in an out-of-court settlement was $200,000. It was a Mother Jones article that broke this story, and that was my source in junior high. Mother Jones article. A passage from that article that I went back and reread. "A Ford engineer who doesn't want his name used comments, 'This company is run by salesmen, not engineers, so the priority is styling, not safety.' Asked about the Pinto gas tank, another Ford engineer admitted, 'That's all true, but you missed the point entirely. You see, safety isn't the issue. Trunk space is. You have no idea how stiff the competition over trunk space is. Do you realize that if we put a Capri-type tank in the Pinto, you could only get one set of golf clubs in the trunk?" Our epoch is rife with lying, cheating, calumny, rife with a kind of malfeasance that characterizes the case of the Ford Pinto. We're learning now that in the U.S., Congress and pharmaceutical companies have colluded to sell the drugs that have fueled the opioid crisis. In 1984, pesticides leaked from the Union Carbide plant in Bhopal, India, killed somewhere between 3,000 and 15,000 people, and more than 50,000 people later died or became seriously ill because of exposure. Sure enough, it was cost-cutting around safety measures that led to this disaster. Until very recently, even though we drastically reduced its use here in Canada, this is something people at MUN know all too much about, because we get emails every single day about it. Canada remained one of the world's leading exporters of asbestos, chiefly to developing countries that really have poor safety standards for handling and using the material. The White House Commission on the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster concluded that cost-cutting around safety measures and safety testing by BP and its partners led to the disaster. Tobacco companies knew for decades about the health dangers associated with smoking. They concealed their knowledge in order to keep selling cigarettes. Per capita, Canada sold more weapons in Southeast Asia in the Vietnam era than any other country. In 2001, Enron disclosed a quarterly loss of $618 million, which stunned everyone because it looked like they were doing pretty good until we realized that they had been cooking the books, which is a euphemism, I guess, for lying. And executives at Enron, of course, we learned, sold their shares prior to coming clean about what they had been doing. And we're just learning a lot the past couple days about Canadians, wealthy Canadians using offshoring to avoid paying taxes. So reckless conduct, malfeasance, deceit, lying, calumny, putting profits literally ahead of people's lives is all too characteristic of corporate culture. One of the reasons I'm mentioning this is because this title is Do We Really Care? But I think what really interests me, and I think what we ought to think more about, is those people, those institutions, those groups of people that really don't care. And they really don't care. And this is very difficult for me to wrap my head around, and I think from what you're saying, it was maybe a little difficult for Aquinas to wrap his head around too, that people just really wouldn't care. Of course, this isn't just the private corporate sector. In the wake of 9/11, 75% of the American public supported the invasion of Iraq because, as one study sums it up, the Bush administration successfully convinced the public that a link existed between Saddam Hussein and terrorism generally, and between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda specifically. Here, I guess, successfully convinced means lied. So I do want to suggest, maybe slightly contra what Sean said, that there actually is a lot of care out there. In November 1969, there was an anti-war protest, Vietnam War protest in Washington. There were 500,000 people in the streets. That's not an insignificant number of people protesting. Nixon reportedly said, "I understand there has been and continues to be opposition to the war in Vietnam on the campuses and also in the nation. As far as this kind of activity is concerned, we expect it. However, under no circumstances will we be affected by it." If I were to translate Nixon a little bit, he's saying something like, it doesn't matter what the people want, we are going to do what we want. In New York, prior to the invasion of Iraq, there were again 500,000 people in the streets protesting. Still, Iraq was invaded because it doesn't matter what people want. We will do what we want. Polling over the last decade shows that among NRA members, National Rifle Association members, about 75% of them are in favor of mandatory background checks before anybody can buy a firearm. In the population as a whole, I believe it's about 90%. But the NRA Board of Directors, which consists of about 70 people, I think the NRA membership is like 4.5 or 5 million, those 70 people or so that run the board are against mandatory background checks. Why? Because they are not serving the interests of the members of the NRA, they're serving the interests of the gun industry and the gun lobby. It doesn't matter what the members of the NRA want, they're going to do what we want. Already in the late 1980s, there was in Canada massive, popular, and a good deal of political support to clamp down on offshore tax havens. The Harper government, I was no great fan of them, but they did try for years to pass legislation that would clamp down on offshoring, and it was blocked at many turns. They finally succeeded in 2013. Why did it take so long? Because it was blocked by law firms like Davies Ward, who represent billionaire families like the Bronfmans, as we are learning these last few days, who hide their money in offshore tax havens to avoid paying taxes. This is from a Wall Street Journal article from 2013 that was written sort of at the height of the anti-austerity protests that were taking place across Europe. The title is called Europe's Institutions Pose Counterweight to Voters' Wishes. And again, this is the Wall Street Journal, if you can believe that. It's a bit of a long quote, but the French, Spanish, Irish, Dutch, Portuguese, Greek, Slovenian, Slovakians, and Cypriots have to varying degrees voted against the currency bloc's economic model since the crisis began 3 years ago. Yet economic policies have changed little in response to one electoral defeat after another. The left has replaced the right has ousted the left, but the economic policies have largely remained the same. Governments will continue to cut spending and raise taxes, labor markets will be liberalized, service industries deregulated. Once you take economic policy out of the hands of voters, what is left? Said Vernon Bogdanor, professor of government at King's College London. This is extremely important because our current political reality is such that public policy is now largely out of the hands of the public, and it rests with a small minority of wealthy people. who use their power and influence to control legislative and regulatory agendas. This is the conclusion of a professor from Princeton, Martin Giles, in his book from 2012, Affluence and Influence, Economic Inequality and Political Power in America. His basic conclusion in the book is that the bottom 70% on a wealth income scale have virtually no impact whatsoever at shaping policy. With respect to climate change and environmental regulations, Giles writes, the public's interests and the interests of organized lobbying groups are usually at odds. American citizens are typically supportive of strong environmental regulation, while interest groups tend to align in opposition to environmental regulation. Again, what the public wants doesn't seem to really matter. If you get looking, I think, at issue after issue, there's actually a good deal of popular majority support on things like minimum wage, health care, more money for schools, progressive taxation, greater fines for white-collar crimes, banking regulations, and improved climate policy and environmental regulation. Just this past April in New York, there were 200,000 people in the climate march. Again, if you look at polling data, vast numbers of people want improved policy. But there are people who just really don't care. And those people that really don't care have differential power in setting the legislative agenda or confusing issues through deceit and lies. We have 69 of the world's top economies are corporations. Corporations like Exxon that pours vast sums of money into climate denial campaigns. Robert Brulé, who works in sociology and environmental science at Drexel University, has been one of the leading figures studying this phenomenon. He finds that funding sources of climate denial movement in the United States, it's largely groups like Koch Industries, the Koch brothers, and companies like Exxon that are funding it. And since the early 2000s, this money has been very elaborately hidden behind shell organizations and companies and foundations, so it becomes very difficult to figure out who is financing it. If a lot of people don't care about climate change, it might be in part because they've been convinced, largely through advertising, which, as we all know, works, even though we think it doesn't work on us, it still works. There's nothing to worry about other than the fact that this whole climate change thing is a hoax. So we sit here in the ship pub and try to figure out how to mobilize action on climate change, as we should, and people do it all around the world. But the Koch brothers have $120 million over the past 10 years or so to dump into climate denial campaigns, and that is extremely difficult to compete with. Polling tells us that 3 in 10 American adults don't buy the idea of anthropogenic climate change. 6 in 10 conservative white males don't believe it. A Pew Research poll from 2016 says that 15% of conservative Republicans agreed with the statement, the Earth is warming mostly due to human activity. If you try to find a Republican politician who will acknowledge anthropogenic climate change, you can't find them. But I still think that these 6 out of 10 conservative white males aren't the problem. They don't care, that's very true, but they don't care because they've been manipulated, they've been lied to, they've been cheated into not caring by those who really don't care. In Canada, these people that really don't care go under names such as the Friends of Science, the International Climate Science Coalition, and the Heartland Institute. The Friends of Science was kickstarted by a $175,000 donation from Talisman Energy, which is a Calgary fossil fuel company, to lobby against the Canadian government ratifying the Kyoto Protocol. Talisman's CEO is a man named Hal Kvisle. He used to be the CEO of TransCanada Pipeline. He's from Innisfail, Alberta, not too far from where I grew up. And he's a good friend of one of my best friends, a guy named Jim Morrow, who worked in public education and actually became the first non-Native director of a Native Friendship Center in Red Deer. Anyway, one day, Hal Kvisle phoned Jim and invited Jim, this is September 2002, to a birthday party he was throwing for him. And at the end of the party, he gave Jim a bottle, said it was really expensive whiskey, but what it was wrapped in was even more expensive than the bottle. Jim was quite surprised at this, told me about it, said he hadn't unwrapped it, invited me over a few days later. We unwrapped the bottle of whiskey to find a map of Iraq with the pipelines that TransCanada was going to be building in red across. And this is in September of 2002, and the invasion took place in March of 2013. There is a correlation between those who really don't care about climate change and those who have the power to block changes to climate policy and environmental regulations. The correlation is they're the same people. They are the people who will not deny themselves satisfaction of their greed, aggression, or sexual desires, and will not hesitate to harm others through lying, cheating, and calumny if they can get away with it. So, among the activities of FANE is to see what we can do to try to stop them from getting away with it.